This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello there. Very good afternoon to you. Today, the owners of the biggest cattle station in the world, Anna Creek Station, have been charged over allegedly building illegal dams on inland rivers and waterholes. We'll take a look at that shortly before the news headlines at 12:30. And a WA researcher says there's likely to be more job losses due to high energy costs and low alumina prices. And of course, just before one, it's off to Mount Barker today for the results of the cattle market. 12:05 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. First today, the head of Western Australia's Stud Merino Breeders Association says it's time to get on with creating a national strategy to create stability and direction for the Australian sheep and wool industries. Sheep Producers Australia launched its Future Flock Strategy concept last month, with a plan to deliver it by July next year. It received an $800,000 closed grant to create the strategy, but Wool Producers Australia says it has no idea about the strategy before it was launched and it was excluded from the process. Now, numerous state farm organisations are drafting a letter to Sheep Producers Australia asking for more information and expressing their concern about the transparency of the process. Others aren't so worried. President of the Stud Merino Breeders Association of WA, Grantley Mullen, says he's happy with the contribution and the consultation from Sheep Producers Australia.
We've been informed about it, absolutely, right from the get-go. We had a phone call from Sheep Producers asking if we had any people in mind to be on the panel, the Future Flock panel, which I believe they've had 25 applicants. I'm not privy to the mix of ones from Western Australia, but we certainly put names forward to who we thought would be pretty good people within our industry, and suggested to them they apply, but we're not sure if those particular people did. But we certainly, right from the get-go, we had a phone call from Sheep Producers. Binya Murray rang and just wanted to, told us about what was happening.
And that's been step one, is working out, right, who's going to be on the panel and asking you for feedback of who you think would be good on this Future Flock panel.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's obviously still in early stages, but taking a step back, we were involved with all the meetings with co-design. And out of those meetings, there was a pretty clear message from producers that were at the meetings. And there's a lot of industry players when you go to those meetings, but I tend to listen to the commercial producers that are in the room. And a lot of them are saying they just wanted stability. Obviously, the live export ban didn't create that. It created the opposite. Yeah, they wanted stability. They wanted more communication. They wanted some alignment between if it was going to be the processors that they're going to have to sell to instead of the live export boats. They wanted a bit more, transparency and a bit more communication from them. And I think a strategic plan going forward is the only way really you can tick that box from what the producers in the co-design workshops firstly clearly said they wanted.
So it's clear to you that there needs to be some sort of strategic plan or some sort of national policy. But when you think about that stability, that hasn't really happened when you look at the debate that is now playing out, because Sheep Producers Australia received an $800,000 closed grant from the federal government to create this strategy. And the debate now is looking at the appropriateness of how Sheep Producers Australia received the money and where it's come from. The criticism is that that money was earmarked to assist WA businesses. It wasn't to create a national strategy. It was for WA. Where do you sit in that debate that's now playing out?
Yeah, we had our own meeting last Friday, our annual catch-up before our harvest, and we talked for about half an hour, 40 minutes on it. We went in looking at it with positive eyes, to see what the benefits would be. And the conclusion is that out of all the grant money that has been allocated, I think this one has the ability to have the most lasting impact. Back to what I said before, producers said they wanted stability, more communication. And I think if you look back to the early 90s, there were strategic plans done with the meat industry, with the cattle and the sheep industries. And I think you can firstly say that We've been going ahead in leaps and bounds in the lamb industry. Obviously, we had that glut 2 years ago, but other than that, it's been a pretty exciting industry to be in. I think back when I was involved in some initial talks earlier on, early 90s or mid 90s, when I was first home, and we're debating the price being between $2.60 and $3, and now look where the price is now. I don't think it's an accident that developing a strategic plan. Yeah, they did that in the early 90s, and now they're planning on doing one for sheep and wool. Saying that it's not earmarked for WA, well, there's two obviously sheep producers in control of two sections of the grant money. One's just earmarked for WA. This is the future flock is national. I think the industry is national. I mean, you only got to look at the amount of back when those hard times we couldn't get any sheep into the abattoirs here, the amount of sheep that went on the trucks across the border. Obviously, WA was affected the most from the live export decision, but I've certainly got friends and producers that I know in South Australia where a lot of sheep went across the border into their abattoirs and crashed their price as well, right when they're in the middle of a drought, one of the biggest droughts I've ever had. So I think it needs to be a national plan. It's pretty exciting if we can get a national plan done and get everyone on board. I'm not worried about how the process come about, because I think at ground level, people like Sheep Producers Australia and WASIA, the two organisations that have been under attack, they are the ones that are sitting on the meetings doing a lot of the work. I mean, Darren Spencer and Valerie Pretzel and Bindi Murray and Bondi Skinner have done a lot of work in early days with co-design. Once it became pretty clear that the live export ban was going to go ahead, they were pretty vocal in their opposition to the ban, but once the co-design process started, they were right in there trying to get the work done to help producers.
So you're comfortable with it, but then just we've now heard that there's this draft letter being written to sheep producers, and that's coming from a range of farm organisations and Wool Producers Australia, also expressing concern about the process, the transparency. So that indicates that this is more than just a debate between two groups, that there is broader concern about the transparency. You're still comfortable even hearing about that letter?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I listened to that yesterday. We were supposed to actually catch up for a chat before that. Coincidentally, this happened after that report yesterday. But, yeah, we've got no concerns, absolutely none. As long as there's outcomes for producers, and as I said, out of all the funding that's being handed out, and let's face it, it's not a lot of money considering what's happened to us. I mean,
well, yeah, just break that down, Gruntley, because this debate initially is about this $800,000 grant. But when you put that back to what has been lost on the ground, how does it compare?
I don't think it makes a ripple. I think we're all fighting over scraps, to be honest. I would think that most commercial producers would have lost in vicinity of somewhere between $300,000 and $600,000 over the course of 1 or 2 years from that exact decision, from that decision from federal parliament, the crash in the price of lamb, being able to get rid of them at certain times. We had to hold stock longer than we should have done. Feed costs were high. We all know the story. We all went through it. I think we all would have lost a lot of money, and I think it pales in comparison to what they're giving out. But at the moment, we're talking about this $800,000, and I think this one, obviously there's other grants for infrastructure that some people will get, some people won't. But this one has the ability, if we all get on board, to have a lasting impression and a lasting impact on our bottom line for sheep and for wool.
And you're comfortable with that $800,000. You can't see the point of this debate. You're basically saying we need to get on with this because there's genuine benefit here. But then when you step back and look all up, there was just under $140 million of government money announced as transition assistance because government decided to shut down the live export industry. And that did mainly affect WA in terms it was WA that was using that export industry. So is it important, do you think, when you look at that bigger picture, that $140 million or just under, that WA is prioritised in that spend? You're comfortable with a national strategy from the $800,000, but more broadly, is it important that WA is prioritised?
I think so, but it is prioritised in the WA roadmap one, and will all be the benefits of this one, the Future Flock program as well. And the Chair of Sheep Producers is from Western Australia. I don't know the final panel, but there's applicants that will be from Western Australia. I don't think there's a them and us, and we've got to get rid of that mentality. It is one industry. We'll all benefit from it. The flow and effects from the east affect the west and vice versa. The outcome of this strategic plan will be in the back of how we all we've got the ability to be a part of it from now on in. Each group has I imagine has been contacted or have the ability to contact sheep producers. They've only been willing to offer their time to us, so I can't imagine it's different to anyone else, and contribute. And if we get it off the ground and contribute in a positive manner, it will be successful. If we start fighting over scraps, as we seem to be doing at the moment, well, it won't get off the ground and won't be successful, so it will be a waste of $800,000.
Grantley Mullen, he's president of the Stud Merino Breeders Association of Western Australia, and he was speaking to Joe Prendergast. 12:15 here on the Country Hour. Well, we'll stick with sheep a little bit longer because the price of merino breeding ewes is up significantly on this time last year, but still present very good value for money considering the strength of the lamb and the mutton markets. That's how Elders livestock agent Clark Skinner is reading the market. At the Elders annual special ewe sale at Wickapen earlier this month, the top price was $266 a head, with an average of $229, more than double the previous year. And at the Nutrien sale, the top ewe went under the hammer for $278. Clark Skinner says the current market conditions present a very interesting scenario.
Yeah, on the face of it, it looks like breeding ewes have been selling to a lot higher rates than they previously have been, but given where the mutton market and the lamb markets are, it's actually quite a subdued market compared to where the meat market is.
And obviously we haven't seen numbers like this for a while. How big a change is it compared to this time last year?
Well, I think most of those ewe sales are $100 to $120, you know, in front of where they were this time last year, but the lamb and the mutton market are exceeding that and are significantly higher on a percentage basis than what those ewe sales are. So, yeah, those ewes are actually representing really good buying at the moment, those young breeding ewes.
And for producers on the ground, what does this actually mean? Are they finally starting to see some good money coming back into sheep?
Oh, look, there's no doubt about that. The money has certainly improved, and it is extremely good for sheep producers at the moment. It needed to be after the disastrous 2 or 3 years that we've had, you know, leading up to this year and seeing a full recovery in the sheep market. But it is going to create some problems down the track if we don't sort of get some of these breeding ewes off of butcher's hooks and back into paddocks.
What makes ewes good value even with the recent price jump?
Well, I think it's just their price. So the price of replacement breeding ewe as compared to the price of lamb and mutton, those prices are very, very close together, and in a lot of instances, the price of the lamb is actually higher than the price of the replacement ewe, which means, you know, there's no cost of running that sheep as a ewe lamb or a dry sheep for 12 months, which makes them incredibly good value to buy straight in. If you can swap a lamb for a ewe, you know, straight over, it makes it, yeah, very, very economical to buy them in, and consequently selling your mutton for very close to the price of a young ewe, it makes the maths work. It's a no-brainer. To be buying those young sheep at these sort of values is really, really good value. It probably can't last. Like, it might last a little bit further through the end of this year, but it really can't last long-term because those young ewes in next year, if we take next year into consideration, the white-tag ewe lambs that are going to be held over now by Merino growers predominantly to class and then sell as a breeding ewe to somebody for crossbred lamb production next year, there's not a lot of reason why you would take that young ewe past the wintertime lamb pricing at $220, $30, $40 or $50 to hold for someone to buy as a breeding ewe later on. Like, so a lot of those ewes will end up going to slaughter even at such high prices. A lot of those ewes will go to slaughter, creating a big shortage of breeding ewes going forward.
Does it feel like confidence is starting to return to the sheep industry after a pretty tough couple of years?
It certainly does. Like, it's been a fairly scarring exercise for a lot of people, so it will take some time, and it'll probably take more than one season of good profitable pricing for that confidence to fully return. But certainly there is a bit more of a spring in the step of those breeders, and particularly the crossbred lamb breeders, who, producers who have had didn't probably suffer the full extent of it compared to the merino breeders, who really had the toughest time of it, I think.
And how long do you think this strong market can last? Or do you think we're in for a good run, or is it a little bit too early to call that?
Well, that's an interesting question. So the previous market it went up from basically 2011 when the live export trade was halted with Julia Gillard and the live cattle ban, and that pulled up the sheep job at the same time, and that was sort of, that pulled the sheep market in Western Australia down through 2011. From 2011 through to February 2022, we had a run of 11 years of a little bit stronger market every year than the year before, with some seasonal variations in there and some fluctuations, but nothing too extreme. It quietly crept up all the way through, and it really got ahead of steam up in end of 2021, and then came off the boil in 22 when COVID started to take effect. So we had 11 years of a very solid sheep market. I don't see an oversupply situation coming at us to flatten the job for a little while. Seasons will play a huge part. You know, if we got a drought situation across a large swathe of the eastern seaboard or Western Australia for that matter, that could have some dampening effect on the market. But given we're starting from such low numbers, I think we're going to have, you know, we could probably have some confidence that our market's going to be pretty good for a while.
What's your message to producers who might still be hesitant about buying or mating more ewes this season?
I wouldn't wait around if you're looking to buy ewes. I'd get into this market and buy them now. We might have a situation going forward where the processors will price you out of these sheep, and, you know, as they need them. And I wouldn't be, I wouldn't be sitting around. I think I'd probably be grabbing what I need this year and potentially grabbing next year's ewes as well, because going forward, if the lamb price stays the same as where it is or even contracts a little bit, which I'm not expecting it will, but even if it did, a $220, $230, $40 lamb, you know, it's going to mean that a ewe really needs to be north of $300 for Merino producers or maternal breeders to hang on to those ewes into the future. So if you can buy anywhere around this level, I'd be getting into it. I think it's a pretty good idea.
Elders livestock agent Clark Skinner, and he was speaking to Rachel Boothman. 22 past 12.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
News headlines not far away, around about 12:30 today. We'll check conditions, weather conditions across the state straight after that. And then it's off to Mount Barker just before one for the results of the cattle market. Speaking of cattle, the owners of the biggest cattle station in the world, Anna Creek Station, have been charged over allegedly building illegal dams on inland rivers and waterholes. The station, which covers almost 24,000 square kilometres of country in northern South Australia, is owned by the Williams Cattle Company. ABC reporter Leah McClellan broke this exclusive story. Selena Green asked her what the company has been accused of.
So what's happened is that the company has been charged with multiple counts of essentially building, I guess what you would call illegal dams on inland rivers around Anna Creek Station. They have actually been charged under multiple different laws, including the Aboriginal Heritage Act and environmental laws for creating those dams.
How did this all come to light in the first place?
So according to the court documents, these dams were built sometime from 2017 up until this year. But what happened was a couple of years ago, there were some Arabunna people who were on country. They're the native title holders of that country. And they were there doing heritage surveys for a mining company, which is something that they regularly do there. And they have said that they saw one of these dams on Baltabaltana Creek there and were surprised to see it. So I think once they saw that, they commissioned someone to use essentially, you know, Google Maps, like satellite images, to see if there was anything else on that country. And they say, and this is something that has been in a parliamentary submission, they say that they ended up finding 21 structures on that land. So the court case isn't in relation to 21 structures. They're under the environmental laws, I think it's 7 counts, and under the Aboriginal Heritage Act, there's 2, but they're certainly being prosecuted for some of those dams that were discovered in that process.
And of course, we're bearing in mind here that this is still a matter before the courts, but you have spoken with a representative of those native title holders over that land, the Arabunna Corporation. What are they saying?
It's something that they're obviously very concerned about. as I said, the native title holders for that country. As part of that, you know, of course, they see their role as protecting their heritage and also the environment. And if they see these works that are happening without going through proper channels that might be either disturbing flows that affect the environment or affect important sites for their heritage, that's something that they're going to be very concerned about, which is why, of course, they really looked into it when they started noticing that this had been happening.
The charges that you mentioned, some of them have been laid under the Aboriginal Heritage Act. And how rare is it for charges like this to be laid under that act?
Well, as far as I can find out, this is only the second time that charges have been laid under this Act, and it's the first time they've been charged for, a company or a pastoralist. I think the only other time that anyone's been able to tell me about has been for people who were swimming in a spring that was considered culturally important. So as far as I can see, this is only the second time these laws have been used.
And under that Act, I mean, what kind of penalty could this attract if the company was found to have breached the law?
That's an interesting one, because under the Aboriginal Heritage Act, there have been recent changes to that bring in much more significant penalties. So it could be up to, under those more recent changes, could be up to $2 million for a company. But because of the time that these dams were built, which we think was, you know, 2017, 2018, it's going to be under the previous Act, which attracts a penalty of $50,000. But what might be more significant is under the environmental laws. There are also fines under those laws, which I believe is around $100,000. But the prosecution, through the Department of Environment, I believe, but the prosecution is asking for remediation works, which of course would also be costly if they were successful in getting that through the court.
What have the station owners had to say? Have they responded to these allegations at all?
The short answer to that is no. This is still, in terms of the legal side of things, this is still very early days. The court dates are set down for next week, so we may find next week a bit more information if they do appear in court next week. I have made my best efforts to contact those station owners, but as yet have not heard back.
ABC reporter Leah McClellan. And you can read more about this story. It's online for you. All you need to do is search Anna Creek and ABC for more of the details of Leah's story. 27 past 12. And if you like to fish or you earn a living in the fishing industry, don't go anywhere, because just after we cross to the Bureau of Meteorology today, Richard Hudson will be in the studio to try and shed some light on the likely outcomes from that recent fishing futures forum. Now, he's been trying to find out if Wreckfish West is getting too powerful and influential. And he'll also explain why the opposition is calling for a parliamentary inquiry into the way fisheries are managed here in Western Australia. So we'll get to that shortly. And at the top of the hour today, we caught up with Grantley Mullen. He's the president of the Stud Merino Breeders Association, and he's saying that it's time to get on with creating a national strategy to create stability and direction for the Australian sheep and wool industries. There are a couple of players in the industry headed by Wool Producers Australia who aren't really happy with the way Sheep Producers Australia has handled its future flock strategy, the process and the funding of that future flock strategy. But Grantley Mullen isn't so worried about that. In fact, he's pretty happy with the contribution and the consultation from Sheep Producers Australia. In response to that on the text, it sounds like whatever happens, the outcome won't affect this producer at all. He must be sitting in a very good situation and nothing will affect him. A no name on that. Have the confidence, if you've got something to say, to put your name on it and where you're texting from. This too, $800,000 for a national sheep group, as Grantley Mullen said, will be the best money we could benefit from. Compared to what Fletcher's International got, it's actually peanuts. And considering this company benefited from this decision, it's disgusting to see what they received. Well, what exactly did they receive? Can you shed some light on that? Because those grants that are available from the transition package for producers and processors, those applications have only just gone in. It's a competitive process. So my understanding is they're still being assessed, and none of that money has actually flowed to producers or the processors. If you've got something else to contribute, shed some light on that, please do. The text 0448 922 604. 29 past 12, Jonathan Beale is here. He's got the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. A man has pleaded guilty to murdering another man in Greenbushes in WA's southwest in 2023. The body of Raymond Smith was found on the outskirts of Greenbushes in January 2024. He was last seen alive in December 2023. Kevin Allen Craig Potter had pleaded guilty to murder and is due to face a sentencing hearing in January. Two co-accused, James Hunt and Paul May, who have pleaded not guilty, are scheduled to go on trial next year. The state is on track to record its worst road toll in over a decade, with 162 fatalities so far. An RACWA survey of 370 motorists found more than half felt that dangerous driving had increased over the last 2 years. More than half of respondents to the Transport Priorities Survey said they'd seen an increase in speeding, crashes and near misses. They also reported witnessing more distracted and aggressive drivers. And WA's Chief Justice says the justice system is being plagued by technology issues and a shortage of lawyers. Recent data from the Department of Justice shows it now takes an average of 25 weeks to get a hearing in a magistrate's court and around 60 weeks in the Supreme and District Courts. Peter Quinlan says malfunctioning technology in court sessions is a simple but frustrating problem which slows down the entire system. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much for the update, Jonathan. 29 to 1.
The Country Hour.
We exported the largest volume of lobster.
Celebrating 80 years.
Isn't that quite exciting?
The Country Hour.
Get up.
Part of your community.
Bite the bullet.
And your life.
Keep moving.
For 80 years on ABC Radio.
29 to 1, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Luke Huntington is with you this afternoon. Luke, it's been a real mixed bag across the Southwest Land Division this week, hasn't it? It's been one day it feels like summer, the next it's out with the winter woolies again. What's the story across the Southwest Land Division today?
Yeah, hi, Belinda. Yeah, it's been that story pretty much all of October. We've had these frequent cold fronts coming through, and we normally do see long, long stretches of clear weather. So, yeah, it has been a strange month, and we're continuing the trend with these cold fronts moving through. Today, we're just in the westerly flow, so there are a couple of showers lingering around for far southwestern parts today. So anywhere southwest of Durian Bay down to Albany could pick up a shower today. We've seen a couple of millimetres around the area. Probably another millimetre or two is expected further today, but it should contract to the coast between Perth and Walpole by late afternoon and evening. And we do have another cold front moving through later tomorrow, so that'll probably hit the southwest capes around 5 p.m, move through Perth to Albany later in the evening, and then probably get as far north as Kalbarri, right across to Esperance early Saturday morning. So the bulk of the rain will occur from that late Friday afternoon, overnight Saturday. It's looking pretty decent for the far southwestern corner, so southwest of Bunbury to Albany could pick up to 10 to 15 millimetres. Heading up to Mandra to Bremer Bay could pick up 5 to 10. And once you get into the very far southwestern wheat belt around Northam and into the central parts of the Great Southern around Pingelly and that area, you could pick up around 1 to 5 millimetres. We've also got chance of some thunderstorms with that front later tomorrow again, as well, south of Augusta, across to Bremer Bay, just as the front moves through. Then Saturday, most of the rainfall should have contracted away. We're only left just in the onshore flow, but the front will still be going along the south coast near the Esperance region once we get towards sunrise. So, sorry. Along that south coast, 1 to 5 millimetres is possible between Walpole and Esperance on Saturday. Most of that will be in the morning period. And then inland, up to a millimetre or so is possible southwest of Denham, all the way across to Kalgoorlie and then down to Esperance. So quite a way inland for Saturday, but there will only be light falls. And heading into Sunday, we do see the ridge starting to gradually come in. So a lot of the rainfall therefore will clear out. It's really just the south coast between Walpole and across to Israelite Bay, which may pick up a light shower on that day. And then on Monday, we do see a return of the gusty northeasterly, so temperatures will start to warm up again through western parts of the southwest land division, with temperatures getting into the 30s and into the high 20s.
Let's take a look across northern and eastern parts now, Luke.
Yep, over the northern and eastern parts, we've got some showers and thunderstorms over the northern and eastern Kimberley this afternoon. So that's the trend we've seen for the last couple of days, and that's going to continue throughout the rest of the week. So Friday, again, for the most of the Kimberley and the very far northeast and north interior, we'll most likely see some showers and thunderstorms pop up in that area. Heading into Saturday, again, probably a little bit further west into the Kimberley, so even places like Broome may even get a storm on Saturday. And then also the thunderstorms do work its way into the southeastern Pilbara, into the south interior and into the very far eastern Eucla. Sunday, similar area throughout the Kimberley, the eastern Pilbara, and right throughout the interior could pick up a thunderstorm. And then heading into Monday, we do see the showers and thunderstorms contracting back to the Kimberley and to the very far northeastern interior. In terms of the Eucla there, we've got just a chance of a shower just along the coast there on Sunday and also the Monday.
Thank you so much, Luke. Laurie's just text through saying that I mainly use the Bureau's app for the radar, but it's just stopped working on my phone. Would any of your listeners be having this same issue? I wonder. Let me know on the text. Have you got the same problem Laurie's got? 0448 922 604. Richard Hudson is in the studio. He's got the rainfall figures for you.
Yeah, and this won't take too long. So in the northern and eastern forecast districts, nowhere recorded more than 2 mils in the 24 hours up till 9 o'clock this morning. In the southwest land division, nothing over about 2 mils in the central west. And then in the lower west, Bickley topped it with 4. In the southwest, Mount William topped it with 4. In the southern coastal region, Albany's airport and King River topped it with 3. In the central wheat belt, Northam had a bit of a downpour with 6 mils. Nowhere else in the central wheat belt recorded more than a mil. So, yeah, a bit unusual. In the Great Southern, Brookton topped it with 3. That's it.
Thank you for that, Richard. 23-2-1. And if you want to have your say on the dire situation facing some demersal fish species like pink snapper, jewfish and red emperor, then you'd better be quick because time is running out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Submissions have to be in by tomorrow. So the background on this is 10 days ago, the state government held a fishing futures forum to discuss future management options because their latest research suggests certain demersal species are at threat in some of the oceans off Western Australia's coast. Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis has warned some tough decisions are probably going to have to be made. So as an example, one option might be a complete ban on catching certain demersal fish in certain areas for a temporary period of time, as an example. Commercial, recreational and charter fishers, as well as traditional owners, were at that Fishing Futures Forum I mentioned. So too were fishery staff, who shared their latest findings. So the research findings and all the data, everything was sort of on the table. Prior to that forum, we were told all future management options would be discussed and considered. So just before the forum started, we're a little surprised to hear State Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis say in a media conference, mandatory catch reporting for recreational fishers was not even going to be considered because it was a Labor election promise to not introduce such reporting. Minister Jarvis then doubled down on that point on the regional drive show.
Look, if RecFish West and the recreational sector agree that we should have some catch reporting of select species that are under threat, then we can certainly look at that. But what we did rule out before the election was mandatory reporting of every catch. We just didn't think it was viable.
Okay, but what about for the ones that are under severe risk, say jewfish, West Coast region? I mean, is mandatory reporting by RecFishers for those fish, is that on the table?
Look, I mean, RecFish West, who are the peak body, have said that they are.
You're the minister, though.
Absolutely. And look, all options are on the table. What I've said is we went to the election saying there'd be no mandatory reporting. But, you know,
but that was of all species, isn't it? Is there a distinction here? You went to the election saying there won't be mandatory reporting of all species, but could there be mandatory reporting of some at severe risk species?
So, look, I'm not sure it's workable, and that's my concern, is that it's. I don't think it's workable to actually have mandatory reporting of everyone going out in a tinny catching fish.
Why is it not workable?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that we can rely on that data, to be quite honest.
After Minister Jarvis spoke to Andrew Collins on the Regional Drive show, Shadow Fisheries Minister Kirrily Waugh challenged Premier Roger Cook in Question Time.
Premier, if everything is on the table, why did your minister take catch and holistic reporting off the table?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the minister made comments in the context of the election campaign. The world has changed, and so everything is on the
table. Members of the opposition.
But, Mr. Speaker, what is it that you don't get about the science? Mr. Speaker, there was a reason why we had members of the crossbench. There was a reason why we had members of the opposition. There was a reason why we had all stakeholders in the room yesterday. It's because we all have to act as one.
So the Premier is clearly saying there everything is still being considered.
20 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. What do you think is everything really still being considered? Text through 0448 922 604. A couple of texts already through. Reggie says, read the fishing forum, it's very simple. Until we exchange the gill nets for an actual sustainable method of commercial fishing, we will achieve nothing. This from David, all fishing should be banned. People should eat beef and lamb. And this, when does the government buy back for fishing gear start? The text is 0448 922 604.
Well, since that Fishing Futures Forum, I've chatted to a number of people who have a lot of experience with fishing, aquaculture and dealings with deep-herd fisheries and politicians. And I'm not talking about just a one-on-one chat with one person. I'm talking about four. They're all wondering if Wreckfish West is now so powerful it can influence what our fisheries minister is saying and considering for future management options. So the reason for that concern is because Wreckfish West claims to represent about 700,000 active fishers, and that's a lot of votes. Wreckfish West also claims the commercial sector catches about 90% of WA's landed demersal fish. But no one knows if that figure is even close to being accurate. Some people believe it could be a lot closer to a 50-50 split, but no one knows because there is no mandatory catch reporting for the rec sector. So some other questions that have come through from these people. Why was the Aquatic Resources Management Act abandoned? Was that due to pressure from Wreckfish West? Why were certain commercial fisheries shut down, such as the crab fishery in the Coburn Sound? Was that due to Wreckfish West influence? So the people I've chatted to are wondering if politicians from both sides or all sides, not just the current Labor government, they're wondering if they're more concerned about votes from recreational fishers than they are about genuinely looking after the sustainability of fish stocks for everyone, for the commercial, the rec, for the environment, blah, blah, blah. They've said to me there is currently a giant data gap because no one knows how many demersal fish the rec sector is landing. So they're saying if the state government is dinkum about looking after fish stocks, it should genuinely consider everything to ensure its own deep-herd fisheries department has as much data and information in its hands in front of them as possible, so they can then make the best management recommendations to try to look after demersal fish species and any other species off WA's coast.
Richard, what's the opposition saying on all this?
Well, we just heard from Kirrily Waugh. She's the Shadow Fisheries Minister. She's the Nationals member for Geraldton. She's not currently calling for mandatory reporting for recreational fishers, probably because she realises there's votes in it as well. But Kirrily Waugh has launched a petition calling for a parliamentary inquiry into all of Western Australia's fisheries. And in just the last 3 days, they've already had 700 signatures. So the opposition is calling on the Cook government to deliver a long-term sustainable fisheries strategy to protect the future of the state's fisheries. Kiralee Waugh says WA's fisheries sector is on the brink of crisis after nearly a decade of Labor mismanagement and a revolving door of fisheries ministers. She says this is about finding balance, evidence-based solutions that work for everyone, including fishers, the environment, traditional owners and the broader community. And Kiralee Waugh wants an inquiry that would also look at things like the impact illegal fishing and energy exploration have on fish stocks. And she also wants an inquiry to ask if DPIRD's fisheries department is adequately resourced. But I wonder if such an inquiry should go even further.
What are you thinking?
Well, I've heard from, as I say, at least four reliable sources that via an FOI request, Freedom of Information, they found out that DPIRD fisheries staff advised former fisheries minister Don Punch to take action to protect fish stocks. For example, possibly reducing quotas, catch limits, that sort of thing. I've heard one of DPIRD's recommendations was to reduce the number of days wreck fishers can catch certain species to 90 days. They claim their FOI revealed Don Punch actually ended up ignoring that. He doubled that figure to 180 and then added another 20 days. I might add, I have not seen that FOI document yet. But if it's true, I wonder what those fisheries staff members thought of that. I'd imagine most work in the field because they're pretty passionate about looking after fish stocks.
So if you do want to have your say on this situation, pretty dire situation facing some demersal fish species like the pink snapper, the jewfish and the red emperor, you have until 5 o'clock tomorrow.
And if you're doing a search, it's actually pretty tricky to find. I'd recommend putting into your search engine demersal fish have your say. That, to me, was about the simplest way to find the website on the DPIRD page and then with all the appropriate links, etc.
Richard, thanks for that. 14 to 1.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
We'll head to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market just before the news at 1. First, a WA researcher says there's likely to be more job losses due to high energy costs and low alumina prices. Up to 100 people at South 32's alumina operations near Collie could lose their jobs or be redeployed, with the redundancies blamed on low prices and cost pressures. UWA Finance Professor Raymond De Silva Rosa says the industry uncertainties are no surprise given the dramatic drop in prices.
It was around $700 a metric ton in the fourth quarter of 2024, just about this time last year. And now it's just under $330 a ton. So that's a substantial drop. And Australia is one of the higher cost countries in terms of producing this. And so the economics didn't stack up at that point with the cost of electricity, et cetera, and all the mining. So it wasn't a surprise. There's been an oversupply of alumina, and partly because there's a decrease in demand, and also China's been increasing its output as well. So it's just been a supply demand kind of issue. Oversupply, not enough demand, and that's what's resulted in the dramatic drop. There's often not a lot of stock buildup, so any slight mismatch between supply and demand can cause, if there's more demand than supply, then the price goes up. So that shows that big increase up to 700 and then now a dramatic drop. It does make it hard to plan the dynamics of this particular commodity.
Do you see it bouncing back in Western Australia?
Probably not. And now I don't have a great deal of insight into this, but the fact, it takes a long time to ramp up these operations and decrease them again. And so you had the company late last year, had approval to increase its production of alumina, and then you had a whole lot of people protesting about that, and they were disappointed. My point here is simply that even the company, which would be far more informed about the situation than I am, doesn't see much prospect of a recovery, because otherwise it wouldn't be laying off. It's costly to lay off people. I mean, you've got to pay them off, but it's also costly to to put them up again. So I would say this is a sign that the industry as a whole, that people within the industry think there's a permanent decrease in production capacity.
It's understood that there won't be a decrease in production. And there's also, like you mentioned, they recently got that sign off for their Boddington mines as well to expand the area where they're taking bauxite from. So is it a bit kind of mixed signals?
Well, it's mixed signals in the sense that they're only responding to the market. The price was really high and then it's just dropped a lot lower than people thought. It's really very hard to predict this, and if you have to commit millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in expenditure, it's quite an excruciating problem for the companies. Given what they know, they're probably looking at the worldwide situation and thinking, no, we just don't see the price recovering. It could recover if demand unexpectedly picks up, if the world economy picks up. But my guess is that they're looking at the increased capacity in China and thinking, no, that'll probably soak up all the available demand for the moment, and there's not much chance of the prices going back up.
So do you expect we might see some job cuts to come or some kind of delay in those expansions planned for the mine in Boddington for bauxite?
I think so, yeah. It's unfortunate. It's easy for someone like me to talk about this on an abstract basis, but I appreciate there are, you know, people's jobs, and the uncertainty is not great for anyone. Yeah, the psychological issues and everything, it's unfortunate.
There was also one that came out that Australia's largest aluminium smelter over in Newcastle was struggling with the cost of rising energy and had kind of called on the government to intervene in that space. Is it just, struggles all around across Australia in this space at the moment?
No, absolutely. So we're in a situation where we're in a country where we actually should have quite cheap energy, and we have different sources, but we don't. That's where we are now, and that's why we have, you know, industries like the aluminium industry struggling to retain a presence in Australia.
Is it a matter of time before we stop producing alumina in Australia?
I think so. Certainly, it's becoming harder to get environmental approvals, and then the cost of electricity is going up, so it's becoming increasingly less attractive for companies to invest.
UWA Finance Professor Raymond De Silva Rosa speaking to Jackie Lynch. 9 minutes to 1. Western Australia's dairy farmers are wondering why one of the big national dairy companies is adding reconstituted skim milk to some of its products sold here in Western Australia. This issue was raised by dairy educator Damien Foley, who also milks a few of his own cows. He recently looked at the fine print on a Master's high-low milk carton and was surprised to see it says it contains reconstituted skim milk.
I wasn't aware that reconstituted milk is actually being used in milk, fresh milk in Western Australia, until I did the Royal Show this year. I happened to be there, I was presenting, I was talking, as I always do, about what a brilliant world-class dairy product we have here, which we do. That's acknowledged as our milk being amongst the best in the entire world. And I had a person come up to me and say, I think you might be stretching the truth a little bit there. And I initially just dismissed them because I thought, well, that's just one person. I then had another person come up and say the same thing. So I went and bought the product, which happened to be the high-low product, and I was surprised to see that there is reconstituted skim milk in there. Reconstituted means milk powder. Now, this is at a time when you would expect dairy farmers to be producing pretty solidly. It's not at a time, for example, where you had a bushfire go through Northcliffe 3 years ago and you had smoke taint the milk, so the milk couldn't be used, you know. Mm. And so to me, it creates the bigger discussion. Is this the tip of the iceberg? Have we now tipped over into the stage where well-known, reputable companies are having to use skim milk powder or milk powder to offset the fact that they've got a lack of supply? And that's a question that's much bigger than me. That's a question for the industry. But it also touches on the food labelling laws as well, because unless you are a really astute consumer who reads the back of the labels,
which most of us don't
know.
You wouldn't know.
No.
Dairy educator Damien Foley speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos on The Morning Show. 7 minutes to 1. Now, we did approach Masters for an interview to address some of these concerns. The company did not put anyone up for interview and did not send us any information, any statement to explain why it's have recently been selling fresh milk with this added reconstituted skim milk here in WA. WA Farmers Dairy Section President Ian Noakes is not aware Masters is doing this, and at this stage he's not overly concerned.
My initial reaction was surprise. I had no idea. As a dairy farmer, I never buy milk. I drink our own, so I never read the labels. But it was surprising to me.
On the label online, it says that this only happens occasionally due to seasonal shortages in fresh milk supply. Does that explanation stack up for you?
It's not the explanation that I did ask about it. And they add a bit of milk powder to it sometimes to make sure the quality is up to where the standard it should be. I wasn't aware that, you know, that it's actually doing it when there's shortage of milk, because I don't think that's correct. I think it's just added when it needs a bit. Well, when the process takes fat out of the milk, must take some nutrients out, and so they add some back in. That is my understanding, whether rightly or wrongly, I'm not sure.
What kind of impact does a move like this have on our local dairy farmers who are working hard to supply fresh milk every day?
Overall, it's probably not a big impact. I don't know the amount, so I'm sort of bit blind there, but I don't think it's a major impact. I don't think Hilo is a big seller. Most people drink whole milk, you know, milk that's not which is as it is, you know, a normal standard. And what I've been told is it's fairly minor, so I could stand corrected, but that's my understanding. Yeah.
And just from a transparency point of view, do you think companies should have to make it more clearer when reconstituted milk is being used in their products?
I think it's more a milk powder being added to the majority of the product is still cow's milk, fresh milk. So, yeah, but I think it is on the label, as I read, since you made me aware of it, and it is quite open on there. If you read the label, I think it's not hidden, so I think it's fair.
And just looking ahead, what do you think needs to change to make sure processors can support local farmers and maintain consumer trust all at the same time?
I think they need to make consumers very well aware that their milk is 100% from WA. Even that product is mostly WA milk. So it's had an additive to it, but I think the majority of it is still WA fresh milk. So, yeah, that's what they should be. They should be making sure that that's the case, and as a doing a dairy political work, it's a major concern to us about how milk production is dropping in this state, and generally speaking, farmers aren't being paid enough to keep them in business. So that is more a concern to me than anything else. Even the majority of that product is fresh milk, and then it's had an additive to it. So. And the additive, my understanding, is a milk powder, which is not coming from WA, it's probably coming from Victoria. But it's a hard one, but I think if you understand, if that is it, it basically is a West Australian milk product. That's the main thing. I rang the local Masters rep here, and he said it's a minor thing, and it's not. They don't see it as a concern.
WA Farmers Dairy Section President Ian Noakes speaking to Rachel Boothman. It's 1:30 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And we'll get to Mount Barker in just a moment.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Hurricane Melissa brings death and devastation to the Caribbean, the Bahamas now in the firing line. September shock. Businesses count the cost of higher than expected inflation figures. How much does it really cost to raise a child in today's economy? And Farlap, the musical, the legendary steed, honoured in not one but two productions for its 100th birthday. Those stories and more on The World Today.
At the Mount Barker sale yards this morning, cattle numbers were down by almost 500 on last week. Tracy Kilner has all the details for you.
A mixed quality yarding with prices reflecting. A larger supply of new season weaners with lightweight steers selling to 502 cents and heifers up to 404 cents a kilo. A lesser quality yarding of yearlings saw steers remain firm while the heifers eased. Heavy cows eased 10 cents while heavy bulls resurged, selling to 302 cents a kilo. Angus cow and calf units sold for $2,800. The heavyweight weaner steers made from 424 to 468 cents and 430 to 502 cents for the lighter weight steers. Weaner heifers returned 386 to 396 for heavyweights and 350 to 404 for the lighter weights. Yearling steers sold for 400 to 480 cents, while yearling heifers returned 320 to 402 cents a kilo. The grown steers weighing over 600 kilos made 360 to 365 cents. 500 to 600 kilo steers returned 360 to 400 cents, and lighter weights made from 360 to 412 cents. The grown heifers eased under 540 kilos, sold from 320 to 370, and heavier weights returned 300 to 370 cents. Heavyweight cows sold from 280 to 316 cents. Medium weights returned 262 to 312. And the store cows gained with feeder demand, selling from 200 to 270 cents. Heavy bulls were up, returning 198 to 302 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for going through all those details for us this afternoon. On the ABC, right across WA, it is news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.